Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
We have merch. Check out the AmericanGlutton.net shop. We've got t-shirts, hoodies, hats, and more. A number of people have come up to me wearing American Glutton merch, and nothing fills my heart with more pride than seeing somebody in one of these t-shirts. And I've been stopped on the street and asked where to get it when somebody sees me in an American Glutton hoodie. Well, you can get it all at the shop on AmericanGlutton.net. And my favorite t-shirt, Yesterday It Was Tomorrow, Right Now, is up now. Get it while supplies last.
Hi, I'm Ethan Suplee. Welcome to American Glutton. Outside of acting, my two favorite things to do are diet and eat. I have a very complicated relationship with food, and on this podcast, we're going to talk about all of it. Food as entertainment, food as sport, food as fuel. I'll talk to experts and the average person, just like you and me.
I hate to ask you to do anything, but if you're enjoying the show, please take a moment to like, subscribe, rate, review, all of the above on whatever app you're getting it from. Today I'm talking to Sheridan Skye. She is a coach at Team BioLane, and she specializes in pre- and postnatal programs. She's awesome. I had a lot of fun talking to her. Please enjoy our conversation. You can find her on Instagram at Sheridan Skye Fit. Sheridan Skye, welcome to the American Glutton Podcast.
Thank you for having me. Stoked to be here.
Thanks so much for doing this. You are part of Team BioLane, which I am a big fan of. Will you tell us what Team BioLane does?
Yeah, so I joined Team BioLane last year in May. So Team BioLane is a coaching, I guess, company formed by Lane Norton, who is a very well-respected leader in the industry. And so Team BioLane basically has a whole bunch of coaches who specialize in certain things, but most of the time we're helping clients through body composition changes or health-related changes. And it's really great because we have such a diverse group of coaches that can help a very diverse group of people.
And is your specialty focused in any one area? I mean, I think I know the answer to this, but I'd rather have you say it. What are you focused on?
Yeah, so mostly women's health, specifically pre and postnatal, but I also help a lot of women through fat loss changes or even muscle building as well. So they kind of go hand in hand with the at least postnatal client. But before then, I've been working as a coach in the industry for over a decade now. I'm mostly focused on fat loss and body recomposition changes.
Okay. Some, like I spent my formative years in Hollywood. And so I knew a few girls in Hollywood who, you know, I don't want to call anybody out, like Jamie Presley, who I love and who's so wonderful and who still to this day, like, works out 6 days a week and is like jacked and looks awesome and has had three kids. Mm-hmm. I remember when she had her first kid And like moments later, like you blinked and she looked exactly the same as she did before she was pregnant. Now, in like what I consider real life, like the rest of the girls that I've known who have had kids, this is not the case. So that aspect of like, you know, because I don't know. I don't want to throw out a bunch of cliches, but like you're eating for two and then like I know my wife would become ravenously hungry and thirsty even when she was breastfeeding.
Yes.
And so there's like a lot of stuff happening physiologically that can be, you know, anathema to weight loss.
Yes. Yes, exactly. And look, that is some women's experience where they kind of have a baby and almost immediately it looks like they return to their pre-pregnancy formation. But for the most part, that's not the case. And I think that we have this idea that it should be the case, and women particularly place a lot of pressure on themselves when that isn't the reality for them. So I think it's a combination of factors that can be challenging for women, first in their prenatal space, so, you know, their pregnancy. So you have, how many kids do you have?
Four.
Four. Okay.
I have four kids and a granddaughter. So I, you know, there's a whole lineage happening. So I've seen my kids have kids.
Yes. I have a question for you. Is being a granddad like the best thing in the world?
It's insanely amazing. You know, like my youngest kids have expressed some jealousy about how I feel about my granddaughter. It's just so amazing because you do realize that there's that, like, you know, as a parent, you assume this position of like, I am utterly responsible for this person. And that means I actually have to say no sometimes, though, like, I don't want to say no. I feel that as to teach them about, I don't have to teach this kid anything. I can give this kid everything. I don't ever have to say no to her. It's really wonderful.
Yeah. And you also have the gift of hindsight. You know, I look back, my girls are only 4 and 2, but even now I look back and I'm like, oh man, I could have done that so much better. Or if I had the opportunity to do that again, I would do it this way. So you've accumulated the experience of 4 children and then put that into your grandchild. So that's really awesome. But
yeah,
you know, it's in our pregnancies, I think we're getting better at this because we're having more and more research come out about, you know, resistance training and the metabolic requirements in pregnancy. But up until now, it's been pretty abysmal. And so women go into pregnancy, obviously carrying this child, wanting the best for this child and wondering, if I do this, am I going to hurt the baby? If I do that, is that going to be wrong? And I value and respect medical professionals' advice. I'm a registered nurse myself. I appreciate the system there. But we're not, unless a healthcare professional cares about learning about that, it's just not something that we have training in. So women are told, don't lift weights. You know, you're eating for two. And it's like, okay, one, we're not actually eating for two. If you really look at the energy demands of pregnancy, it's much lower than we think. And you mentioned that your wife was a lot hungrier when she was breastfeeding, a lot thirstier. And that does actually match up with the metabolic demands of breastfeeding. It costs so much more energy to produce breast milk and feed a child than it actually does to grow them, right?
Oh, wow. I didn't know that.
Yeah. So there's a few different recommendations with how many calories are required in pregnancy. And the Australian recommendations from memory recommend no extra calories in trimester one. They recommend an additional something like 300 calories in trimester two, an additional 500 calories in trimester three. But then when you look at I'm pretty sure it's the UK guidelines, don't recommend any extra calories until the third trimester. And then they only recommend an additional 200 calories, which is a very big difference, right? And it's complex because as women advance in their pregnancies, their bodies change a lot more, right? We tend to slow down in a general sense. Some women don't, but that can reduce the amount of movement that we do. And so while our body mass is going up, and that's largely determined by how many calories we actually need, it's like BMI, right? BMR, we can become less active. And so that increase kind of is compounded by the fact that we don't move as much. But, you know, it is such a big difference between like thinking 200 calories and then 500 calories. That's in pregnancy. Now, when we go to our postpartum period, the first 5 months of a baby being exclusively breastfed, women need sometimes up to an additional 600 calories a day above their maintenance.
Wow. I had no idea. I don't know why, but I would like, and I've seen it now with my daughter too, but I remember my wife being like so parched, and that I kind of understood, like, okay, you're getting rid of liquid and so you need to replace liquid, but I had no idea that, and you know, like even off the top of my head, I know I'm wrong, but I think that I just kind of assumed like the creation of a human being to me seemed so much more complicated. So I always figured like that must take a lot of energy, and the creation of milk, it's just like, doesn't seem like such a big deal to me.
Yeah, totally. And I had that thought process as well. I thought it would have cost way more to grow a human than it does to feed a human, right? But it actually doesn't. And the thirst is, I remember that I would be out grocery shopping with my husband and I wouldn't have a water bottle. And I'd be like, I need water now. You know, hangry, like how you get hangry. Like, I don't know what the equivalent is for thirsty, but I'm like, I need it now. So, you know, women, it's really tough in their postpartum period because, you know, we've birthed the baby now, right? So we kind of step into this, oh, now I can change my body composition. I can go back to what I looked like before. And we can look in the mirror and not hate what we see, but it's different. We see a reflection that doesn't represent the body that we know because it changes, right? And I think that there's a societal pressure where it's like, you know, you're pregnant and you're glowing and you're beautiful and then you have the baby and it's like, okay, wrap up the evidence. Why aren't you back to where you were before you were pregnant, right? And so there's that pressure from women, but then there's the demands required for breastfeeding, but then there's also the sleep deprivation.
Yeah.
And as you know, Ethan, when we look at sleep deprivation, if we remove having a newborn and the complexities of raising a child, sleep deprivation makes a lot of things really challenging. It drives up your hunger hormones. You are at increased risk of losing lean body mass. You don't make as many rational decisions when you're not well rested as you would if you were, right? And so women have kind of this multi-layered, all these challenges that are multi-layered. And I think we just place a lot of pressure on ourselves to kind of bounce back to where we were.
Yeah. I mean, the pressure is immense. Listen, I'm a dude. I haven't actually experienced the pressure myself, but I've seen it and I've seen the burden that some gals that are very close to me have put on themselves. And, you know, I understand feeling that pressure and that need to change, but I also go like, you got to cut yourself some slack, right? For all the reasons you just listed. Plus you're doing this brand new thing and, it's complicated. And like, you know, that other part of it, like the getting back to pre-birth weight, you can put that on the back burner. That's been my opinion, but that's also easier said than done. Like I can say that to somebody and then have them go like, well, go fuck yourself. I'm going to do this now and pull my hair out crying.
Yeah. But I totally agree with that. And it's, you know, as a coach, it's never my job to tell women what they should and shouldn't do. Right. And I think that your experience, Ethan, as a male is totally valid because you've watched, you know, your wife carry and bear 4 children, right? And you've watched her place that pressure on herself, whether that was her experience or not. But it is true. There is sometimes a right time and a not so right time to be working toward things. So when I'm speaking to women who have just had a baby and it's very common for them as soon as they have a baby. Hey, I want coaching. This is what I want to do. And I work collaboratively with my clients. I don't ever say yes, no. I say, look, these are the options that we do have. These are the pros and cons of some of these options. These are my thoughts. What do you think is the best thing that we can do going forward? And the reason I do that is because whether or not I take her through a fat loss phase or not, somebody will. And I would rather do it in a way where if she's going to choose that for herself, it's in a way that will support her recovery as best as it can, support her breastfeeding and providing the nutrients needed to her baby. Because I say to clients who are breastfeeding, I'm like, I don't have one client, I have two. Because what I take from you, I take from your baby. And that's very important because the first 1,000 days from conception to growing are the most integral years of a child's life in terms of receiving certain micronutrients that are imperative for their life, right?
But how old is that? 2 years old for the baby? 1,000 days?
Yeah, so it's from conception to, so 1,000 days from conception. So I think it's around two, just a bit over 2 years old. And my daughter only just turned, she's 2.5 now. So it seems like she's been alive for a lifetime, but it's not a long time in the grand scheme of things, right? But when we look at breastfeeding, a question that women often have is dieting safe during this phase of life? And the answer, the short answer is yes, it can be. It can be. So the research shows us that where breastfeeding is well established and there are no issues with supply, your baby's gaining weight, then a conservative fat loss phase won't necessarily decrease your milk volume and your ability to feed your baby as they need. But so like that, and when we quantify that, that's really maybe 0.5 kilogram per week. Loss.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. So it's a pretty decent amount. I know a lot of people think of that much amount of weight and they're like, oh, that's not really a lot. But if you know, compound that over 52 weeks, that is a lot of weight, right?
No, but so you're saying like you can reduce by like 500 calories a day.
Yes. Like if you're on the leaner side, then I would reduce that to make sure that you're not losing more than say 0.75% of your total body weight. And it's not that it will, if you were to do that for a leaner person, it would impact their ability to feed their baby. But if I take 500 calories away from someone's maintenance who's say 2000 calories and bring it down to 1500, that's not super low calorie. Like most women are dieting on around about that, depending on their, maybe
I mean,
not men.
Listen, I just in all fairness, the women in my life, so this is like not my children, but like my wife and her friends, you tell them 1500 calories and they're like, what do you want me to get fat? You know what I mean? Like 1500 yes, calories yes. is like a lot for these gals.
Yes. And I've been there. I remember I had a coach once who put me on 1500 calories and I was like, hell no. Now if I'm in a dieting phase and someone puts me on less than 1800, I'm like, I'm going to starve. I'll be dead in a week. It's like, I've come a long way. But yeah, it sounds like a lot of calories. But even if we think about 1500 calories, the risk is that when we reduce food, we reduce micronutrients. Right. So there are some very specific micronutrients that are really important for not just mum, but her baby. Right. We've got like iodine, we've got calcium, we've got vitamin D, we've got iron, we've got choline. There's a whole variety of foods, micronutrients that are really, really important. And so when I take food away, I take those things away or potentially. Right. Now, most mums, and I don't know if this was your experience, it's just with both of you and your wife going through that newborn stage, no one's in the kitchen cooking up gourmet, beautiful meals. You're grabbing whatever you can with one hand. And if it's your wife, it's like, if it doesn't fit in my hand and I can't pick it up with this one hand, I'm not doing it. Would you agree?
Yes. I would love to hear your idea on this. Cause at the time I was like, that's not possible. But I remember my wife would eat stuff and then say that whatever she ate made the baby gassy. And I was like, I don't see how that's possible. Like you're, and she'd be like, you can't give me cabbage anymore. It's making the baby gassy. And I'm like, how does that work? But so my wife was pretty good about getting healthy food, but I do know what you're saying. For us, I think that came later when we were trying to feed our kids and it was like, they were on the chicken McNugget and mac and cheese diet. And we were like, well, we got to cook this. We're not cooking something else. So this is now what we're eating too.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And so like for some women that is the experience, you know, they take what they can. And so that's already reducing the amount of micronutrients that they get in their diet. So if I am taking a woman through a fat loss phase in the postnatal period, I really try and encourage her, hey, can we just push it to at least 12 weeks? Like give your body time to establish your feeding, because when baby is born, it's, you know, your milk supply is driven by hormones and like it's a feed and supply loop. So demand and supply loop. So if your baby takes it, your body says, okay, this is how much my baby needs. I'm going to make that again, right? But after we have our baby, it's also driven by a lot of hormones. And that doesn't, like it's always hormonally driven. But when we establish our breastfeeding and our body learns what our baby actually needs, it's really off of that demand supply loop, right? So, you know, when women first have a baby, they'll notice their milk volume is disproportionate to what their baby needs. And that's why, you know, I remember my husband being like, holy damn, like you're, wow. And I was like, this is, you know, your boobs are just so big. And I was like, yep, it's the milk. But that settles, right? That settles right once your body learns what your baby needs. And so I like women to wait at least until they've been able to establish that. But then also, you know, a baby's not in routine at 3 months, but it's not as frequent as it is when your baby's like first born and your body's had an opportunity to heal a little bit. Women are still healing months postpartum, but at least you've given your body a chance to heal a pretty decent amount before you start reducing calories.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think that's a good idea. I just think, we're in the, not that it was necessarily different 20 years ago, but we're in the day and age where like everything has to happen immediately. So the baby's out, you know, I can walk again. You know, some people have C-sections and then it's like, you cannot work out today, right? You gotta wait for your stitches to come out at least or something like that. But even if you didn't, stuff like to your point is healing for a long time. It's okay to like not worry about it, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. And the time passes and, you know, your kids are much older, right? I think that you think it'll last forever and it doesn't. You know, right. The days are long. The days are very long, but the years are very short. You know, my daughter turned 4 just last month. And I think I spent 3 days crying, being like, how did this happen? How are you 4 already? How has this already happened, right? And I think that we feel like things have to happen right now, but they don't, and the time passes anyway. And I think that if we can just remove shoulds, I think that should becomes a cage, then we can really ask ourselves, what is most important in this phase of my journey? And am I placing a bit too much pressure on myself to do everything? And I think that that comes a little bit more with first-time mums than it does with the wisdom of, you know, multiple children. And that's not always the case. And I'd love to hear your thoughts on how you saw the evolution of your wife, because, you know, when I had Ellie, my first baby, I still existed in that time and space where I was Sheridan, the person who was only responsible for Sheridan, really, right? I had all these things that I wanted to do, my routine. I was very, control was my forte. I had to control everything. And I think that children become this lesson that there is so much in this life that you cannot control. But after I had my first baby, I still existed in that time and space where I didn't yet have my new identity as a mother, and I didn't step into the mother until maybe I had my second baby, where it just became so, this is going to pass. It's all going to be okay. I just need time. What were your experiences like with yourself and your wife going through that?
Yeah, for me, the biggest thing with kids, And the biggest kind of learning experience that I've had is I'll have this idea about my kid, and I find that my idea, which, like, if I really examine it, is truth for me, right? Like, my kid is X, or my kid is this, and this is what is correct for my kid. And then I'll be shocked by them expressing to me something which shatters whatever my idea was. And yeah. I go like, wait a second. Wait, what are we talking about here? No, you're going to college and you're going to be a doctor or whatever version of that we're talking about, right? Yeah. And like, I've had to realize over and over and over again, that's a person that mm-hmm. that I'm involved with, that I was totally responsible for. And as they grow, my responsibility diminishes. But that's another person, and they have their own ideas about me. Like, I'm sure I could shatter their reality about what they think of me if we had the right conversation. You know what I mean? Where I was like, no, that's not how I see the world at all. You know, talking to them about God or something, where I do believe in God. But it's not like I believe in a guy in the sky with robes who's like playing chess with us. And like mm-hmm. trying to communicate to them, they're like, you believe in this guy sitting about moving us? And I'm like, no. And they're like, we don't believe in God. And anyway, like, just the realization for me that this thing, which was so truly helpless and truly mine to be responsible for and to shape for so long, has now grown into a person that is truly their own person, can be totally flummoxing sometimes and totally beautiful too, you know. And so there's a lot of things that I have had where I had ideas about my kids that I found out were not correct, you know, and I've had to become okay with that. And you know, it's nothing so startling, but I become rigid sometimes, and that rigidity has had to go away, and I've had to become more malleable to, like, this is another person I'm dealing with, right? I can't just be a dictator and enforce my will on them. Let's have a conversation. Let's figure, you know. And then there are lines, like when they're 3 years old, they're just absolutely not allowed to juggle knives. I'm sorry. I'm going to put the knives up high, and I'm going to cover up the electrical sockets so they're not digging around in them. You know what I mean?
Yes.
And then one day we're going to have a conversation about knives and electrical sockets, and then they're going to have to choose how they navigate those things. And I will have nothing to do with it at that point. I'll have to let them go, which is really makes me very nervous still. You know, when half of my kids have finished college and are living their lives, it still makes me nervous.
I'm not ready. I'm not prepared for that.
Yeah, it's a lot. No, it's a lot to deal with. I know you're at the point right now where you are still having to put the knives up high. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. And you're right, though. You do see your children as a bit of an extension of yourself. And I guess it's a hard lesson to learn. Oh, you have your own desires and your own thoughts and your own identity. And it's really just my job to guide you as best as I can through this very complex thing called life. But I'm not there yet. Pray for me.
Yeah. No. I had a friend who doesn't speak to his parents anymore. He was in school as an engineer, and his parents, you know, this was a big deal for them. And then he quit to become a comedy writer. And that was his passion. Mm. And his parents like flipped out about this, and he doesn't have a relationship with them. And this to me is so tragic and heartbreaking. And so I really like, I psych myself up sometimes. I create scenarios and try to navigate them mentally for my kid to come and tell me something so wild that like shocks my foundation so much. And I have to be okay with it because, you know, unless they come and say like, I'm a serial killer and I'm going to do all this awful stuff, then, you know, there are boundaries, right? There are limitations. There are no absolutes in any of this. Like within reason, I want to be okay with whatever they tell me. And I want to allow them to be people, not an extension of me.
Yes. Yeah. That makes a lot of sense. And I guess because I'm not yet there in life, I've kind of just gone through the identity change of Sheridan the person to Sheridan the mother. And she's forever evolving, right? But I think that, especially for those first time moms, they're learning what it is to surrender. I think that's the best word that I can use to describe parenthood. And just we can still work toward the things that make us light up and are important to us. And I think that that's really important to outline to women, whatever that is, whatever lights your soul on fire, whether, for some people, being in a fit body that is muscular represents hard work to them. It represents how they see themselves. And when they move away from that in pregnancy, and they're not one of those women who do bounce back like that, they start to question that identity. And if they still have those parts of themselves. And they do. It's just that you're also juggling parts of other human beings that are so reliant on you. And so I think that the best advice I can just give women is it doesn't have to happen in the first 3 months postpartum. It doesn't even have to happen in the first year postpartum. And you do start to get back a little bit more independence, a little bit more, a little bit more, a little bit more. And it comes, it just feels that in the moment, it'll be like this forever. But I promise it's not.
Well, I got to tell you, I love the data that you've given to me about the amount of energy it takes to create milk being larger than to create a person. For me, for so long, it was just my will against the world. And so I would choose these diets that were very hard and I could get through them. But it was like it used every bit of my intention and attention while I was doing it. Like I couldn't do really much else. And I'd get to the end and I'd go, fucking did that. I did whatever, something awful for 60 days. I lost lots of weight. I'm strong, but now I've done it. And then I'd gain the weight back, right? And life in this cycle got so much easier for me when I got more and more and more data. You know, when I learned about the homeostatic and the hedonistic pathways to hunger, I understood like, okay, there's a difference between my body needs fuel because it's using fuel, and I've just walked into a Best Buy and went to buy something, and I'm surrounded by chocolate, and this chocolate has created, forced my mind to think of chocolate. And that thought is creating a hormonal response, which is making me feel hungry. Those are different things. And navigating those with the understanding of what's going on is much easier than just white knuckling your way through it. And so I think like this is like amazing. Like I can't wait to tell every woman in my life, do you know that creating breast milk takes a lot of energy? Cut yourself some slack, you know? Like
Eat the
eat the food. If you're hungry, don't starve yourself. Your body is doing a complicated process which requires energy. Eat the fucking food. Or don't beat yourself up for being hungry, you know? Like yeah, you're hungry. It's as though you did a workout. You know, I get when I'm working out, I get more hungry. And I can't be upset with myself about that, whether I'm dieting or not. You know, if I'm trying to lose weight or I'm maintaining or whatever, if I go do a gnarly workout, I'm going to be hungry at some point later that day, especially if I don't eat enough, you know? So, like,
Yes,
I just think
absolutely.
that kind of stuff, understanding that, like, epigenetics play some role in this too. And that doesn't mean that I give up and I go like, well, I just have the epigenetics that, you know, accelerate fat storage. So, but knowing that, I can navigate it a little better, you know?
Yes. Oh, I have so much to say on that. So, yes, absolutely, I agree. And I'll just touch a little bit on how energy demands change throughout the breastfeeding journey because they do. And then I want to address what you mentioned about hunger and hunger cues because I have this conversation with, majority of my clients are mums. But I'll touch on that soon. But when we look at energy demands during breastfeeding, if you exclusively breastfeed your baby, so no formula the first, say, 5-6 months of life, when your baby will then start solids at around 6 months, your energy demands are the highest then, because your baby gets all of their nutrition, all of their energy from your breast milk. If mums kind of mix feed where they have formula and they have breast milk, their energy demands are probably going to be a little bit lower because of that demand supply. They don't make as much, or their baby doesn't take as much because they're being supplemented with formula, and therefore their body doesn't create as much. So that can reduce the amount of energy, right? Then when we introduce solids to our babies at around 6 months, that's generally around, or at least the recommendations are by 6 months, start introducing solids for a variety of reasons, but mostly iron stores are efficient or sufficient for babies until around 6 months postpartum, or their first 6 months of life. But breast milk doesn't supply enough iron for babies to meet their needs. So we need to start introducing foods that are high in iron to make sure that the baby is topping up those iron stores. But when we introduce those solids, if I don't know if you can remember back that far, Ethan, or even your grandbaby, they just spit everything out. They're not really swallowing anything. They're not very efficient.
They gum it for a while. Yeah, right. Yes. Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. They're like, what is this? They spit it, they poke it out with their tongue. But they start to get better at that. And around 9 to 10 months old, they are a bit more efficient at swallowing and taking in food. So normally, anecdotally, what I see with my clients is around 9 to 10 months, if they have been exclusively breastfeeding, I notice that their energy demands start to dip. And that's because I collect the data, right? My clients weigh in, they track their food. And so I can learn, oh, okay, this is where around about I might notice their energy demands start changing. And then as the baby gets older and older and older, some women stop breastfeeding at 12 months. Some people, you know, don't stop breastfeeding for years, but still majority of that baby's, or that now toddler's, nutrition will come from solid food rather than breast milk. And the breast milk is really supplementing the diet as opposed to the other way around. So for women, they kind of wonder, how many calories do I need? Like, is there a calculator that I can use for that? And the answer is no, because it's very complex. Like, how much does your baby feed? What is the size of your baby? Do you have twins, triplets, singletons? What is your scenario, right? And so I like to say to women, look, you can go to a calorie calculator, whether you go to like TDEcalculator.net and you determine roughly what your maintenance calories would be at your current activity, your current body size, knowing that that calculator won't take into account breastfeeding. You might add an extra, say, 300 calories, maybe a little bit more depending on where you are. Follow that for 2 weeks, take your weight daily, and then look at what happened to my average, not daily, my average weight from week to week. Did I lose weight? Then you're in a calorie deficit. Did I maintain weight? You're at maintenance. Or did I gain weight, right? And I like at least 2 weeks. If women are willing to push to 4, I like that, because as you know, like, fluctuations in weight are very normal, especially as women. And so that's what I like to say to women, like, just to be sure, just collect the data and know that if you go to a calculator and you eat 300 calories above that, you're not going to gain, you know, 20 pounds overnight. It's fine. It's going to be okay. And so just being aware of how those energy demands change throughout your breastfeeding can help women to feel a little bit more in control and like, okay, if I'm eating a bit above, it's okay. And how to adjust from there.
Yeah, no, I like that. I like 4-2. This anecdotally, but my experience was when I first started counting calories, and I don't, in fairness, count calories at all anymore, but yeah. I did for a while. And I noticed that what happened was this, is I did the TDEE calculator, found this number, and then I was like, okay, now I'm going to graph it. And what I think happened was I'd measure my food. I was very meticulous. But then because I had begun counting it, I wasn't finishing everything. So I had this number and I was like, I'm losing weight at this number. And then a month in, I'm like, I'm not losing weight anymore. Well, now I'm really hungry and now I'm eating all my food, and it had to be adjusted a little bit for me. My caloric needs were actually slightly less than that calculator said, which is completely normal. But yeah, that's why I agree with you. I think like give yourself a long time to actually figure out what is correct for you. Yeah. None of this has to happen immediately. And the
exactly.
And those numbers are really just a guide.
Yes. It's just data. It's like I say often to my clients, you know, if they head into the weekend and they overconsume calories, I'm very cautious to use the word binging. I think we really overutilize that word these days where humans, we overeat. Like, you know, we overeat. There's a difference between overeating. There's a difference between binging. When I'm overeating, I know what I'm doing. I'm like, man, this pizza is good. The company is great. I'm going to keep eating it, right? Whereas binging is like really, it's kind of like an out-of-body experience. You don't realize that you're doing it. And so I think that language really matters around this. But if they say overeat on the weekend and then they're like, oh, I've stuffed it, you know, throw everything out the window. I kind of like to use this analogy. It's like, you know, if we're saving for a house or whatever it is, or we all have budgets, we tend to not spend as much Monday to Friday because we're working, we're busy. And then the weekend comes and we splurge a little bit more, right? We're more social. We go out with people. And sometimes on occasion, we spend more than we anticipated that we would, right? If we have a really good weekend, if the company is really good, we spend more. But on Monday, we check our bank accounts because we're like, oh, shit, like, am I eating noodles this week or am I going to be able to buy food? And it's like, okay, we check our bank because it's just data. It shows us, did we spend too much? But what we don't do is notice that we spend too much and then say, I'm going to draw all of this out and just give it to everyone because what's the point? I've already spent it all. But we do that with our nutrition, our food, that all or nothing where we overconsume and then we have this like, well, I've stuffed it. Like it doesn't work. I'm going to give up. And it's like, it just has to be data. And I think if we can learn to remove that emotional attachment to it, it does just become about data. And for people like you, Ethan, like you said, it's like that there was power in that for you. That's where probably things changed. Would you agree?
I mean, night and day, the ability to navigate my experience with diet and weight loss is night and day with data and like useful data. Mm-hmm. There was data before that was like, you know, carbohydrates are making you fat. Stop eating carbohydrates. You will solve the whole thing. And I would lose weight and then I would stop losing weight. Then I would gain a little weight and I would still not be eating carbohydrates. And I would be banging my head against the wall. Like why am I broken? What's wrong with me? I'm not eating the thing that's making me fat. I was allergic to carbohydrates and I thought everybody was, you know, I thought we were all walking around with grain brain. And data really, really helped me. And I think the more data that I have, it's like a suit of armor, you know, I become impenetrable because anything that's going on with me, I have an answer to why it's going on with me. And when I have a real why, then I can understand it and I can not always beat it. It's not like I'm just invincible to this stuff, but I swear to God, understanding what's happening makes it less of this, like I'm bad, you know, whereas before anything that I did that was, you know, like if I have this set goal of like, I'm going to eat only this way forever, any kind of deviation from it was just, I'm bad, I suck, I'm a piece of shit. And when I have more data, I can look and go like, oh shit, I hadn't slept. I got on the plane without food. I've broken some of my cardinal, like foundational tenets, right? The dogma of my life has been, I fucked up 3 days ago when I didn't go to the grocery store. So that's when I go like, okay, so I know I need to keep in these things and it will safeguard the future rather than just like, you know, I was unable to eat unprocessed foods when I was on a trip for 3 days in the Midwest and I had no access to a grocery store or a car. And it's like, yeah, what did you think was going to happen?
Yes. Yeah. And that's where you became process driven instead of outcome driven, right? Yeah. So you obviously took your weight, you tracked your calories. These were all outcome metrics. And sometimes the outcome swayed in the way that gave you that dopamine, like I'm killing it, my weight's down, my clothes are fitting. And other times it didn't, right? But when we don't have a process and we don't focus on it, and you mentioned a few things, Ethan, you said, you know, I didn't go to the grocery store this day. I got on the plane without food. You start to think back to your process. What were the steps that I missed?
Yeah.
And how do I improve those things? Because we can't always control the outcome. And like I say to women, you know, one of the questions that we ask at Team Biolane when clients are checking in is, do you have your period or are you due for your period? Because I know that if I see a big spike in a client's weight, and for some women that can be pounds, that can be 3 to 5 pounds in just overnight, they think, what have I done? Like, it's like, we need to change my calories. They'll message me and I'll say, okay, no, it's okay. Don't worry about that. Your process, has anything changed in your process? Are you taking a few licks, bites and sips? Are you having more untracked meals? No, 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 then I am not concerned. Keep going, keep refining. And I promise you in a week, it's going to be fine. So that's just a really powerful testimony from you that you started to detach from the outcome and you started to think about process.
Well, you make a great point. I think the biggest change for me was truly, if we're being completely honest, I'm not outcome driven at all. My outcome is sticking to my process every day. That's the outcome I'm looking for. That is the only outcome that really matters to me. So the scale goes up and down a little bit. Okay, maybe the process needs some refining, but really I'm not doing the life I have today is not, there's no goal. There's no finish line. The finish line is death. You know what I mean? Like there is no weight that I'm trying to get to that right now. That's a number. I could be a little leaner than I am, but I have been a little leaner than I am and it's not fun. And life should be fun also. Like it shouldn't be this debaucherous fun. Where you're just indulgent with like the most base things possible. Like a thought pops into my head. I'm going to act on it. No, that's not the type of fun I'm talking about, but I shouldn't be constantly stressed, fatigued, hungry, and not sleeping. So I sleep. I'm not hungry all the time. I have enough energy. That's it. That's where I'm at. So like maintenance for me, this is the rest of my life.
Correct. Yeah.
It's very, very hard to communicate to somebody. And I don't think I could have, I don't think when I was 550 pounds, I could have come to that. I really don't. I think I needed to do some extreme stuff. I think I needed to do, I needed to fail a number of times. I needed to, I needed to prove to myself that I was capable of weight loss. That was a big deal, you know. 60 days, I did a liquid diet. I lost 80 pounds. Knowing that I could change my condition kind of, I think, has kept me going for all these.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Growing up as a kid, my mom would never let us have real cereal. When I say real cereal, I mean the stuff that you'd find at a normal grocery store. My mom would get us the cardboard shavings at the health food store, and I was always miserable with my cereal. And then I would magically go to my friend's house, and they would have real cereal. And I would be so envious, and I would sit and eat bowl after bowl of delicious, frosted goodness, sugary, wonderful stuff. And then I grew up and I was able to buy my own cereal, but that lasted all of 2 minutes because then I started dieting. So cereal left my life entirely. Well, not anymore. Not anymore. Now there's Magic Spoon, which is high protein cereal. My favorite flavor is their peanut butter. It's incredible. Variety pack. Four flavors are cocoa, fruity, frosted, and peanut butter. This pack has 0 grams of sugar, 13 to 14 grams of protein, and 4 to 5 grams of net carbs. Only 140 calories a serving. It's high protein, has 0 grams of sugar, keto friendly, gluten free, grain free, and soy free. It's incredible. Go to magicspoon.com/glutton and grab a variety pack and try it today. And be sure to use our promo code GLUTTON at checkout to save $5 off your order. And Magic Spoon is so confident in their product, it's backed with a 100% happiness guarantee. So if you don't like it for any reason, they'll refund your money. No questions asked. Remember, start your day off right with a delicious bowl of high-protein cereal at magicspoon.com/glutton and use the code GLUTTON to save $5 off. Thank you, Magic Spoon, for sponsoring this episode.
Years.
Yes. Yeah. But that's shown in the research, too. Like, that's not yes, we don't want to be promoting crash dieting all the time, but it's like, I think when people have tried so many times to change, especially when it's, you know, when they're dealing with obesity and they're dealing with a lot of body weight and they've done it and it's not worked, they start to develop an insurmountable amount of evidence that it can't be done. Yeah. And so before they've even tried, they don't believe that they can do it, right? And so some people will ask me, you know, Sheridan, how do I gain confidence? Like, I need confidence to then do the thing. And it's like, no, you do the thing and you develop more and more evidence that the thing can be done, and then you gain the confidence. And with the confidence comes momentum, and with momentum becomes motivation, and you keep going, right? And so I love that. It's like being process-driven. And my realization was when I was in the Air Force, and I was training as a nursing officer in the Air Force, and my husband, he recently retired as a special forces operator. And so he'd been in the military for a lot longer than I had. And I remember at my training, they were asking us to, you know, make the bed, iron it this way, your corners need to be here, you need to get a ruler and make sure it's like this. And I'm very, I'm a perfectionist. And Ethan, it was perfection. I was like, this cannot get any better. And they ripped it off and they were like, that was shit, do it again. And I was like, I'm sorry. And I rang my husband in tears. And he said, Sheridan, it was never about the outcome. No right. matter how you do it, they will find a way to say that it wasn't done, because it's not about the outcome. It's about the journey. How do you react to those things? How do you refine? And I was like, is this life? Like, I don't like this. So you're right. It's about the process.
One sure. of my, kids, her, you know, they do quotes in their senior year, or I don't know, in their yearbooks, they have quotes. And she chose a quote by Camus that said, "We must imagine Sisyphus as having been happy." And, you know, he made it to the top of the hill every day, right? Mm. Like, mm-hmm. he got there. He had to do it every day. But this is fucking life. We got to wake up every day. And if we want to create the best life where we're constantly improving ourselves, right, in tiny, tiny little increments, we're going to have to like do roughly similar things every day. And it's going to have to become a part of our life. And if we are trying to create structures that are fucking miserable, we're never going to find this, you know, and that's the thing. Like, I believe that there is a structure out there for everyone. I don't know what that structure is. I don't think it's necessarily my structure. My structure works perfectly well for me. and then I think with like girls, they're so mysterious to me because they have this anatomy and physiology that's really different from mine. And it's fascinating. Yeah. And I've always been surrounded by them. Like, I had a mom and a sister. I also had a dad, but like, And then I wound up with a wife and four daughters and a granddaughter. and I'm really interested in girls. And I do think that there's so much data out there for me. And again, I'm not looking through the eyes of a woman, so I'm not looking for data for women, but I find it to be slightly more scarce. Like information on menopause, information on periods. That's not in every diet book. It doesn't talk about that. You know, it's not like mainstream. And this is half the population.
Yes. Yeah. And you're right. Like, women are largely, I won't say misrepresented. There's just not a lot of studies that included women. And, you know, when we look at women, you know, men, their hormones are relatively constant for a long period of time and until they kind of get to, you know, the end of life is not the right word to use, but we get older, right? Things start changing, right? But
they
women,
don't, they also don't change in such a dramatic way as women. Yes. Men don't have a change of life. Women have it's a metamorphosis.
Yes. Pregnancy and menopause, right? It changes women. But, you know, in the research, it's like, well, researchers are trying to control as many variables as they can, right? It's like, if we want to determine whether or not there's a causation or correlation, we need to try and keep the variables very, very tight and reduce any noise that could indicate maybe this happened because of that, right? So women, because we have a cycle, our hormones constantly change. Like, we're having these flux of estrogen, progesterone, testosterone throughout the menstrual cycle, where sometimes they're high, sometimes they're extremely low. And so it's like, there's that added complexity for women where it's like, well, did this happen because they were in their ovulation phase where their testosterone was higher? And what if we had have replicated that, say, in their luteal phase before they get their period, right? Would that have been different? We don't know. So it was kind of like too hard basket. Let's put that too hard basket. It's just easier to look at men, right?
We're going to ignore them for that time of the month. And then for the rest of it, we'll just say calories in, calories out.
Correct. Yes. And, you know, we're definitely getting better. I'm very, very hopeful for women that we're getting more and more data and research on women. And it's exciting. And it's like, you even look at things like pregnancy. It's like, why is there not more research done? And it's like, well, when you look at ethics and, you know, some people kind of think that you can just be like, oh, you know, is heavy resistance training safe in pregnancy? It's like, you can't just start with, you know, hey, Karen, I can see that you're 6 months pregnant. Can we put 100 kilos on a back squat and see how you do, right? It's like, no, it's a multi-stage process. And even something like creatine, right? Supplementation with creatine, we know how powerful creatine is. Like, it's the most researched supplement probably in the world, and the benefits are there. Like, the research consistently shows the benefits are there. And it's like, well, how does that translate to pregnancy and postpartum? Is it safe during pregnancy? Is it safe during breastfeeding?
I would love to know.
So we know a little bit about it. The answer is probably,
okay,
but they are currently in the stages. There's an incredible researcher, Dr. Stacey Ellery, at she's in Victoria, Melbourne, so Australia, and she's looking at how creatine supplementation or creatine specifically changes throughout pregnancy and breastfeeding. So we're at the stage in trials where we're going into human studies. Right now we have studies on mice. We have observational studies of like women who have taken it and reported it throughout pregnancy. So the answer is probably, but what we don't know is, because of the metabolic changes happening in pregnancy, do we need a higher dose or a lower dose to get the same benefits? We don't know that, right? So that's what they're trying to find out. And then when we look at breastfeeding, we only have like one study shown from one woman who sent in her breast milk sample to see whether or not her supplementing with creatine increased the creatine levels in her breast milk. And it did. So there was an elevation of creatine in her breast milk, which makes sense. It's passing through the breast milk. But what we don't know is, would that level of creatine in the breast milk impact her baby's developing kidneys? We don't know. Probably not, but we don't know, right?
Right,
so
right.
It takes time. Research takes time to get out there. And I think that the beautiful thing about social media is that researchers who are very good at doing this, but not necessarily marketing it to the outer world to say, hey, we know this. We have people like yourself, Ethan, who love data, and they love like talking to people who know about this to get it out into the world. But yeah, it's just, we're catching up, and I'm hopeful that we'll have a lot more data on women. But it's even the realm of resistance training in pregnancy. It's like, I don't, what would your thoughts be on pregnancy? If I was to ask you, as someone, a male, what would your thoughts be? Or what have you heard about the safety of resistance training in pregnancy?
So I had a pregnant daughter who became pregnant after I got very into data, right? The last time my wife was pregnant was over 17 years ago. And so yeah. I was, at that time, I was super into cardio, right? Like that's all I did. Yeah. And I didn't care. Like the only data I cared about was like, how many watts was I pushing for 8 hours today, right? That was it.
Yes.
And so this time around, I really not knowing anything about it, but I had a daughter who wanted to be as active as possible because she was, you know, pregnant and noticing that she was more sedentary. And so we literally just went online and found Google videos of pregnant women working out. Nothing was heavy. It was all very light weights. And there were even certain core exercises that we found for pregnant women because, you know, the muscles are being really stretched apart and to tighten and strengthen them. And like, I would never have had her doing back squats while pregnant. I wouldn't have done that because I have no idea really, you know, but I know like my other daughter who's super into weightlifting and she's 19. So definitely not pregnant or anytime soon, hopefully, but she loves back squats. So I know they're perfectly fine for gals to do back squats. She loves deadlifts and back squats and hip thrusts. And she wants it all to, she's very obsessed with a big butt. And so like, she wants to do anything that will do that. I would not have had my pregnant daughter work out with her or do one of those workouts. But again, I don't know, maybe she could have.
Yeah, exactly. And it's, I ask because it's a beautiful representation of like, we don't know. So we go to Google like, oh my gosh, like I found myself pregnant as a, you know, I'd been a coach for 8 years, you know, I had knowledge and then all of a sudden I was pregnant and I was like, I know nothing. I don't know how to navigate this. And so all the people that I would generally go to, you know, to be coached, they were like, I don't know, that's too hard basket. Let's put that over there. Don't know. Right? And so when I went to my first obstetrician appointment, you know, the day before I, you know, knew I was pregnant, I was back squatting 100 kilos for reps and I was doing that. And then I walked into my doctor's office and he said, you can't lift anything over 11 kilos. And I was like,
yeah, see, I don't think that's true. I think that's like, too far. Yeah. 11 kilos.
And so I was like, how is this possible? And this could be a whole podcast on itself, Ethan, and I'm very mindful of your time. But what I just want to share with women is that if you have an uncomplicated pregnancy, there is no reason that you can't resistance train during pregnancy. And you can do back squats and you can do deadlifts. And, you know, am I saying that if you've never done it before, I want you to, the first thing I want you to do is to chuck a back, you know, a bar on your back? No, I wouldn't do that with a non-pregnant client. But you know, we have these limitations, like don't lift more than 11 kilos. And that research was done in an occupational setting where women were repetitively twisting and turning and lifting objects for up to 8 hours a day, multiple days a week, where there was a increase in potential complications, like miscarriage, for example. But when we put women in a gym environment, say 45 minutes a day in a controlled environment.
Or gals who aren't doing manual labor, right? Like, if you're lifting 11 pound kilos boxes all day long, yeah, you can skip the gym. I wouldn't even tell that person to go to the gym.
Yeah. And it's like, it doesn't translate to a gym setting. And aesthetics aside, when we purposely decondition women from their pre-pregnancy strength and say, hey, now that you're pregnant, let's decondition you, we are doing women a disservice because they need that strength going not just into their labor, but their postpartum recovery. You know, imagine if I told you for 9 months, Ethan, I want you to do nothing but Pilates and yoga. No, and now I want you to go through the hardest surgical experience of your life. And then I want you to recover as quickly as possible. It doesn't compute. The math doesn't math. It's like we need to support women a bit more in understanding that you can do these things, provided you have an uncomplicated pregnancy, because yes, there are some conditions in pregnancy that make resistance training a contraindication. And I could talk about this forever, but it's like women are still strong and we should encourage them to keep that strength and to continue resistance training alongside a small amount of cardio, because the research shows it improves outcomes both for baby and mom.
Yeah, my feeling has always been right. Like I haven't experienced a complicated pregnancy or had somebody close to me have that. So I don't know. So that's a factor, right? So this takes that out of it. If you're having a complicated, then I'm not talking to you. But I do always think like we're here, and 100 years ago, we weren't sedentary. At all.
No.
99% of the country was in working in agriculture 100 years ago. And that's manual physical labor. And then before that, you know, for a million years or however long we've been here, a long time, if you're super, super Christian, then a few thousand, but it's been a while.
Yep.
We were for the longest time without the possibility of being sedentary. We couldn't. Our lives depended on it. And so we were moving much more. And so I do think that today, you know, there's a little bit of like, I'm pregnant. I'm sitting on the couch for 9 months and not doing anything. Mm-hmm. And I do agree with you. I think that is the opposite of what you should do.
Yeah, exactly. And I even hear some obstetricians say, you know, if you did it before pregnancy, you can continue doing it. But if you didn't do it before pregnancy, then don't do it. And that's just categorically untrue. Even in the Australian recommendations, 25% of women, non-pregnant women, resistance train or meet the standards that would not consider them sedentary. So if 25% of non-pregnant women are only meeting those standards, how much less is it in pregnancy, right? And so even the Australian guidelines, it's like, hey, if you didn't resistance train before, this could be a great time for you to start. And yes, you're not going to do powerlifting meets, but you can do that in a controlled, safe manner. And that is going to be beneficial for your pregnancy for sure. So yes, mums are not eating for two, and they absolutely should feel empowered to move their body and do that without fear that they're going to hurt themselves. And if they don't know, then seek out a qualified pre and postnatal coach. And sometimes, unfortunately, that's not your obstetrician. And I'm not saying ignore the advice of your medical professionals. That's very important. But second opinions are always helpful because sometimes our healthcare advice can do women a disservice.
Yeah. No, I agree. I do think that, you know, there are many instances where our healthcare can do us all a disservice. You know, I get torn because I have one daughter with type 1 diabetes who's been on insulin since she was 4. She's now 19. It's kept her alive. I'm so, so thankful to the pharmaceutical companies. I you know, they have kept her alive. And then there's other areas where I'm like, we don't need to just throw pills at all these problems. Like a lot of these problems could be completely solved through moving a little bit more, eating a little bit differently, you know, and that becomes frustrating. And so I do tend to agree with you. And my kid didn't do back squats, but it's good to know that she could have. And maybe this time, next time around, I'll encourage some back squats.
Your 19-year-old.
Yeah.
Tell your 19-year-old to come to me when she's ready.
Yes. When she's ready, she hopefully this is quite a few years from now.
Yes.
And she'll.
After college.
Yes, exactly. She just has to get through school, which was the only requirement for the other one too, which is awesome. Yeah, that's exciting. Sheridan, thank you so much. This has been such a fun conversation. I really appreciate it. And I'd love to do this again. There's other stuff I wanted to talk to you about. Like, maybe we do another episode and just talk about PCOS, because that's another thing I don't know anything about. And I hear about it all the time as like one of these outlying factors that changes the game. Like, you have calories in, calories out, but if you have PCOS, the rules don't apply totally. And I'm like, what is this? I want to know about this. And that seems to largely be a girl thing too, right?
Yeah. So PCOS, there is some research showing, and again, a very, very big topic, but it affects a lot of women and more women, because we're getting better at diagnosing PCOS, whereas previous we weren't that great at diagnosing it. But there's some research to show that women who have PCOS may have downregulations in their metabolism, which can make it harder to lose body fat. But there's a myriad of different things that women with PCOS could be doing, and also differentiating between, you know, PCOS and endometriosis, because we kind of clump these two conditions together and they're not the same. They're very, very different conditions. So yes, I would absolutely love to come back on anything women's health. I'm very passionate about, and I appreciate you giving me the platform to talk about it.
I'm passionate about it too. And I'm always excited to learn something, and I can't wait to, as soon as we're off, I've got 5 texts to send out to every girl in my family who has a phone about breastfeeding.
Amazing.
And yeah, it's very exciting. Thank you so much.
No worries. Well, you enjoy your night.
You too.
Paige Dorian Productions, welcome to the check-in. How are you doing?
Thank you. Well, I'm doing pretty good. For anyone that hasn't heard, I started taking a weight loss medication called Mounjaro. It's the brand name for something called Tirzepatide. Did I get that right?
I think it's Tirzepatide, but I don't know. Yes, I think you're right. Mounjaro is right. I mean, like, who? Yeah, Mounjaro, soon it will be called Zepbound.
Yes.
You know.
Yes.
Yeah. So how long now has it been? What's your weight loss? Most importantly, what implementations have you done so that one day when you're off of this, the weight doesn't come back? Like, what's that?
Yeah. So, okay. I'm in week 20. So is that 5 months? Which is crazy. It feels like just yesterday. I've lost 38 pounds. I mean,
wow,
I could say 38 and a half, but let's not get so crazy. So I've lost 38 pounds. A lot of it came off in the earliest couple of months, right? 3 months. But like in the last month or two, you basically stay in touch with your doctor, whatever provider. I use an app called Sequence, and I have like a coach and a nurse person, and I can ask all these questions. You stay in touch with them when it's time to refill your prescription, and you can say, okay, yeah, I want to go up, I want to go down, here's what, but I'm just leaving it to them to kind of advise me. But I've also just been trying to be conservative about it, because I get that impulse to go, oh, well, it needs to speed up. But no, it doesn't, right? Slow and steady wins the race. And so in the last month, maybe it's been, I guess in the last 4 weeks, perhaps it's maybe 4 pounds, like maybe 4 to 5. I can't totally remember. I'd have to look. But, you know, at first I had this thought of like, oh God, I should increase. And then I thought, no, like I'm already seeing weird little loose skin in places. I'm already like, I know that this is fast, you know? And so I'm okay with just sticking to the dose I'm on, and I'm not going to increase yet. I'm just going to do another 4 weeks at the dose I'm on and just keep it slower. So,
and you, do you, like, you know, I think one of the things that this was my experience, at least. So I don't want to say in general terms, this is what a lot of people deal with, because who knows what a lot of people deal with. This was what I dealt with. For me, I would have a number as a goal.
Yeah.
And then I would get that number and be like, this is not, this goal is, this is not right. I do not I do not feel different enough. I do not feel that I look different enough. Mm-hmm. What I feel like, and I'm just kind of vaguely remembering in my head mm-hmm. that you initially had a number.
Yeah.
That was like a pound and a half away.
Well, yeah, exactly. You're totally right. Excellent memory, buddy. And what you just said, you've encapsulated exactly what's going on in this moment. So yes, I'm a pound and a half away from my original goal. That's amazing. That's the lowest I was in 2020. Felt the best I'd felt in my adult year. You know, like that. I'm at that place now, and you know, I can fit into my clothes again. That's cool. And I feel better, and I feel better in my clothes. I feel better when I do exercise because, you know, it's a lot easier to exercise with less pounds on your body. Like, all of this is amazing. Oh my God, I'm here now. I for sure don't think it's enough.
Right.
I for sure am like, oh no, I need to stay on this another 5 months. Like, I'm trying to just evaluate what my next goal is. But to your
right.
Point.
Like, this is what I always experienced. You get there, you go, I lost we can say the number, 40
yes,
pounds,
40
which
pounds.
You're on the fucking precipice, another week or two.
Yeah.
I lost the 40 pounds. I want more. I want to lose another 40 or, you know, maybe not. I don't know. But like, mm-hmm. can you recognize, or is it real for you at all, that there might be some part of you that is not going to be satisfied simply with whatever the number is?
I definitely recognize that that is a possibility. And you had someone, well, actually, so I'm not sure when this will come out in relation to when this episode's going to air, but you recently interviewed someone named Beth Wilkes Ferrico.
Yeah, that episode came out today.
Okay.
Or good. Monday. Sorry.
Glad I'm with it. So by the time this check-in comes out, then people can hear it. But she was you guys were talking. I loved the conversation. I really like her too, 'cause she's just like no BS. But she's talking about breaking the cycle of yo-yo dieting and all these things. But she said something like, I wish I'd written down exactly what the quote was, but it was like, do you want to care about how much you weigh, or do you want to care about what you look like? Right. And I thought, yeah, because I'm so scale focused all the time, but I think
there's even another factor, Paige, to consider.
Yep.
How you feel.
Yes.
Right. And, you know, there also has to be the recognition that how you feel is supplemented by this drug.
Yeah.
And so I personally think also with these drugs, there's probably going to be the need for a long-term maintenance where you're going like, I don't want to lose weight. I want to just maintain this weight, right?
Yep.
So how you feel right now might be more about how you feel moving through space and time in your body, right? It might not be the hunger cues so much, because like, you could get down – you could become twiggy. You could take these drugs for a long, long time, become twiggy, or, you know, some facsimile of her, and mm-hmm. Get off of them and be starving, be ravenous, you know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. And so I know that there's going to be some element of I am still apprehensive about what's going to happen, but it's interesting because my hunger has increased since the very beginning. In the very beginning, I was very difficult to eat, and that's not the case now, but it is difficult at times. It's difficult to eat certain things. Like, it's much easier for me to drink a protein drink to make sure I'm getting my protein than it is another piece of chicken. That's just sort of true. But, or I'll think, oh my God, I'm so hungry right now. And then I'll get halfway through the food I made and go, oh, I'm full, you know? So I know there's going to be work to be done in all of that. But yeah, it's just funny because, you know, I have a lot of like stuff I think about in this world of stuff. And it's like, even at my lowest, where I'm technically a pound and a half away from, I never felt like I was thin enough, good enough, looked good enough, none of that. So I'm like, okay, cool. I reached this. Now what? But it is, you know, I think I have silly little goals. I want to be able to tuck a shirt in and wear a belt and that is like literally my new goal is to feel good in an outfit where I can tuck, because I never tuck anything in. I'm always
covering. Practicing? Like, can we see what happens? And obviously, like, if you're not comfortable, you don't have to wear it out of the house. But why don't you begin right now to admire yourself a little bit and start to, like, if that's what it is, if it's, I want to tuck a shirt in and wear a belt, what happens if you do that today? What is that like? And like, also recognize that quite possibly there will never be an instance where you're utterly satisfied with a tucked shirt belt thing. Yep. You know what I mean?
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
I have issues with belts that have never, no matter what my size, it's never, like, they're just not, it doesn't work. I'm constantly pulling up my pants, or when I sit down, because I still have loose skin and I'm still a very big guy, my stomach bulges over the belt and it feels like I'm strangling my lower half. Mm-hmm. You know, if I wear a belt tight enough that my pants don't budge on my waist, and I look at other people who wear belts and I just go, how are you not constantly fidgeting with it? And I have just gotten good with the fact that, like, my body doesn't work perfectly with a belt like other people's bodies. And this has been true at every size I've ever been my entire life. When I was, you know, just a cardio whore and super, super skinny, like legitimately skinny at 200 pounds, I couldn't wear a belt. It would still, my pants would slip down. So then I'd have to choke myself with the belt, you know, choke my lower extremities. And then when I'd sit down, it would be so tight, it hurt. And it's like, I don't see normal men dealing with this. My point in telling you that doesn't have to be your experience, but it could be that this picture you have in your head is just never going to materialize under any circumstances. You lose another 50 pounds. You're twiggy. You're way too thin. You put on a belt, you tuck in your shirt, and you go, fuck, I don't like this anyway. You know what I mean? So my only appeal to you is, like, fucking admire yourself, tuck in your shirt, put on a belt, and fucking admire that today.
Yeah.
And I'm not even saying you have to stop losing weight. You can keep going, but, like, let's start that process. Like, let's have the good part of healthy at every size start entering the picture right now and get some self-love happening.
You're totally right. I am going to try belts on. I don't own one, but I will start to try them on in stores and see. And yeah, no, 100%. And I do think I have made some mental progress, I'll call it, right? Of, like, okay, you know, just because I'm getting to this goal here doesn't mean, I don't know. Yes, would I like to lose some more? For sure. But also, I don't know. I'm just trying to not make less of this huge win. Do you know what I mean? To have gotten here. So I am working on that. And to your point of just to answer your earlier question of things I've implemented that will help me not, you know, go back. I'm eating 3 meals a day. I'm trying to make them balanced. You know, I have this weird little rule that I've stuck to maybe 90% of the time of like, don't eat a carb without protein. Like, don't just make a piece of toast, because my tendency is just to like get a box of crackers and watch TV in bed. So I'm not doing that. I'm like, okay, if I make toast, it goes with eggs. If I want to eat these crackers, it goes with this turkey. I'm really working on those things. And it's like, man, the you know, to use this term, the mindfulness that is required to stick to that stuff is crazy. It's just crazy. And I, you know, when I travel, blah, blah, blah. So I'm working on that. I think I'm doing pretty good on that. I've just got to get into the Dr. Nadolski posted something recently, like, even if you only work out one time a week, it's okay, just because you didn't get the 3 times in. So I'm working on that. Like, okay, I was traveling. I didn't make time to exercise or do anything. I was active, but great. I went yesterday. I'm going to do something this afternoon. Like, I'm trying to be kind to myself, and you know what I mean? But it's the exercise. It's making sure I have enough protein, which, my God, it's difficult. Like, it's hard to get in that much protein without paying attention, you know, like I am paying attention. I'm making sure I have some ready-made protein drinks that I'm like, yep, I better have one today, you know, stuff like that. But I'm working on all that stuff, and I know where feel ready to like go, cool, I'm done now, and I can just be in regular life, meaning without this thing. I'm working on it, you know?
Amazing. You're doing great. I'm proud of you. Keep kicking ass.
Thanks, dude. I'll let you know how the belt goes.
Yeah, let me know how the belt goes. By the way, the fact that you don't own a belt and you can just wear pants, I'm incredibly jealous of you just in that, because my pants, the way my body works is if I sit down in pants that are so tight that they stay up without a belt while I'm standing, if I try to sit down, they'll explode, or they will constrict my body so much that I'll, you know, have experienced nerve damage or a lack of oxygen. And, you know, so the fact that you can walk around in pants without a belt, that is wonderful and impressive. And I'm envious.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to have something you're envious of. All right. I'll check in with you soon.
All right. See you later. Okay. And now for the Q&A.
Today's question comes from Lisa.
Hi, Lisa.
She says, if you feel unmotivated or less motivated sometimes, like I often do, who do you turn to for inspiration or motivation?
Okay, this is great, Lisa. Usually, you know, occasionally I'll run the David Goggins line of like, tell your inner bitch to shut the fuck up through my head. That'll happen occasionally. But more often than not, the motivation that I draw upon is the memory of how much better I felt after doing something I set out to do. So if I go to bed and I know tomorrow I'm going to get up early and work out, and I wake up and I just want to lay in bed, I don't want to get up, I think back to the day before or whenever the last time I was in the gym, and how much better I felt leaving. And that becomes a motivating factor for me. Like this feeling of dis-ease or malaise that has come over me is not permanent. I know it can go away. And how will it go away? It will go away if I start moving. And that's really more than like looking to somebody else for motivation. Now, that said, I do sometimes think about David Goggins saying, who's going to carry the boat, and going like, yeah, I'm going to carry the boat. But that's kind of rare, you know, that I seek external motivation. It's usually within my memory banks of, you know, I realized something too recently, thinking about the first real diet I did as an adult on my own with the desire to lose weight was a liquid diet. I did 60 days, just ridiculously low calorie. And I've been hesitant to recommend anybody do that, because I do not believe a diet like that will get you to any semblance of your ideal life or a goal. Mm-hmm. However, what it did for me was prove to myself that I could lose weight. And so that was a big motivating factor. Every time I gained weight, I knew, okay, I fucked up, I gained weight, but I know I can lose weight. I know I can do something really hard and take this weight off. Now, I wish I'd come to all my conclusions that I have today, because I've cobbled together the structure of a life that I'm super happy with, that is not a struggle every day, where the hardest struggle for me is that motivation occasionally to get out of bed. And I just have to think back, yesterday I didn't want to get out of bed either, or maybe it wasn't so bad yesterday. Maybe it was a week or two ago that it was really bad, where the demons were holding me down in my bed saying, do not get up, life sucks. And that I know I pushed through that and I went to the gym, or I took my dog on a walk, or I stood outside and got sunlight in my eyes and I felt better. And it's that that gets me out of bed now. And similarly to that first diet I did, the fact that I was able to lose weight just proved, like, undeniably to myself that I could be successful in this pursuit. I didn't know how to keep it off. I didn't know how to change my, you know, compulsions and behaviors and habits back then, but I knew without a doubt that I could lose weight. And so I often think of that, you know, that was really fucking hard, but I did it. And so I think if you have any moment of triumph in your history that you can draw upon, for me, that's the best motivating factor, to look back at the memory of any triumph and know this feeling that I'm feeling right now is not permanent. I can do something about it. I just have to go. I just have to start.
That's an awesome answer. I love it. And Lisa, we hope that that is helpful to you. Let us know. If anyone else has a question, you can email it to us. It's hello@americanglutton.net.
Thanks for listening to this episode of American Glutton. I'm Ethan Suplee. You can follow us on Instagram @American Glutton Podcast. Sincerely.